Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the expansion of our consciousness. It seems at this point in our history, many people are awakening to something beyond the personal individual I experience. And one of the leaders in this field, one of the people who've been at this work for many years, at the forefront, is tonight's guest, Richard Moss. He's written the book years ago, The I That Is We, The Black Butterfly, The Mandala of Being. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hi, Alan. Thank you.
As I said in that introduction just a second ago, is that this idea of a consciousness shift is something that awakened in you many years ago. I know you've talked about it in the past, but can you describe that and how it's actually changed for you and deepened for you over the years?
I think, there's a T.S. Eliot poem or part of his poem where he says, to arrive at our beginning and know it for the first time. And I think that's what awakening is, or the experience that I had, is you arrive at what has always been fundamental and essential truth, but has been masked or lost by the way we are educated in our culture. Our education is all about breaking things into parts and losing perception of wholeness and interconnectedness. And suddenly what happened to me when I was 30, that's a long time ago now, 37 years ago nearly, was a spontaneous awakening. People call it cosmic consciousness or realization, but really it is it's stepping out of the conditioning of the mind of the fragmenting of reality through the way our intellects operate, and suddenly once again experiencing that everything is interconnected, nothing is separate from anything else, nothing at all is ever separate from anything else, except in the human mind, in a particular way the human mind creates language and structures and names and labels. And so that experience was a return to the beginning, a return to the essential wholeness of consciousness and wholeness of awareness. And it changed me utterly because, I mean, at that point I was a young doctor, very much immersed in the reductionist philosophy that science follows in our world today. And having been educated in the 50s and 60s the way I had been educated, it was, we're all blind to how much we have lost the sense of the oneness of all things.
But was there something that
really deeply.
Did something precipitate that shift? I mean, were you, or did it just come out of nowhere for you?
Well, that's really very hard to answer. You know, maybe it in a way was precipitated because I had pushed my mind. It's not easy to become a doctor, and it's not easy to go through internship and residency and put in all those hours, and struggle with mastering very elaborate concepts and also practices for the application of those concepts. And then I had also become a mountaineer and a rock climber as I had more and more free time, and that was where I had the experiences in nature of flow and of oneness. But I also pushed limits. I took myself to over 22,000 feet on my own feet, which isn't, you know, very much if you compare it to Everest, but certainly in the Alps, in the Andes, at that age, and coming to those limits and facing fear and pushing my limits, in a way, I think I was setting myself up for going beyond the limits of my mind as it had been trained and conditioned, and my body. So maybe that precipitates it, or maybe it's spontaneous. I don't think anybody really knows, but we know there's a history of this. We know that some spiritual traditions work very hard, as in, for example, Zen and certain other traditions, through experiential processes to awaken this undeveloped part of us or restore us to a sense of wholeness. But we also know that the real lineage of whatever we mean by enlightenment or realization is generally spontaneous. It's not generally linked to traditions. So there's always someone at the foundation of a tradition who has had some kind of experience that changes their way of looking at the world profoundly. And if they can integrate that and maintain sanity and aren't immediately crucified or punished as heretics, they leave behind a legacy of their new insights. And so I would say that I fall into that kind of lineage of spontaneous realization and transformation. And where it comes from or how it happens, I don't know.
Well, there's been, and also since you've had that awakening, there's been many in kind of an American mainstream culture that has woken up. I mean, there's Eckhart Tolle, there's Byron Katie, people with genuine awakened experiences that are now coming public that are adding to, I call it, a new cultural foundation of spirituality in this country, anyway.
It's true.
But for you, in the 37 years, has the experience changed? Has it deepened? Has it... I'm interested in how it has evolved over the years for you personally, your experience of it.
Well, talking the experience is one thing, and there are many people who do it well. I think the integration of the experience is a movement into greater and greater humility and simplicity of life, economically and in every possible way, simplicity of life. And certainly my life has become simpler and simpler. What matters to me is just moment by moment appreciation of what is, love and loving and being loved. So that movement towards simplicity, that movement toward humility, that movement toward just spontaneous enjoyment of life as it is, almost no matter what, that's just deepened and deepened. And in that sense, there's enormous freedom. And in the beginning, I was still the overlay of my old ego patterns, the overlay of my old conditioning was still quite strong. It wasn't eradicated by a realization or awakening. It's been more the discipline and practice of living in the present moment that has taken root and brought my life to where it is now. And yes, the experience evolves. The insight evolves, the understanding evolves, but it's not as if some experience of bliss goes deeper and deeper and deeper, or some explicit experience of transcendence goes deeper and deeper. It's just ordinariness that is transcendence. It's just simplicity that is deeper and you know, you start right now. There's nothing but now, and the only thing that ruins this moment is what we think about it, what we believe. And so I just don't listen to a thought that in any way contracts me or closes me down. And I know those thoughts are never true. So they have no effect. And as I live more and more in trust with what is, life is simply what it is, beautiful. And then this consciousness transmits itself to everyone and everything. I don't know, I can't prove that it transmits to everything, but it certainly transmits to people. If I just stand up in front of a room of 50 people or 400 people, within a minute, there's absolute dead silence. Nobody's moving. Kind of fidgety, agitated people come up to me afterwards and say, you know, for the last hour and a half, I didn't move at all. I can't remember a time in my life I didn't move. And the reason they didn't move was because they were in this field of this deeper consciousness, because it's in everyone, so everyone responds to it when they're near it. And so it transmits that way, and more people, through messages like mine and Eckhart Tolle's and Byron Katie, as you mentioned, are finding practices and ways of being reminded of what has always been the case.
But, you know, it's interesting, you talk about practice, but then previously, and you talked about it just happened. So, I mean, that's always been the sort of contradiction, let's say, in spiritual practice or undertaking by what you said. It just sort of happens, like you said about your own experience. And then there's a compulsion to teach happening or to share it, and yet it still has to happen. So those are two things I don't quite understand how they go together. You know what I'm asking?
Yeah, I think I do. But I think you're just talking about a paradox, the paradox of between being and becoming. In every moment, we are exactly as we are. And at the same time, through the choice I make right now, I become a little bit different in the way I say yes to things or no to things, the way I welcome things or don't welcome things. I change the future. So I'm in a constant arc of transformation. But that arc of transformation starts right now, always starts right now, even though this right now was influenced by all the previous right nows. It's like if you hear a great violinist and you decide you want to play the violin, well, then you've been awakened to a desire to play the violin, but you'll never play very well unless you practice. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the years that I've spent with people, with groups, with people in retreat, with counseling people, guiding people, and the years I've just started long ago to walk my talk, to practice the things that were bringing me more and more simplicity of being and fullness of soul and heart, they've just continued as practices. So there's practice and there's grace. There's effort and grace. And there's no contradiction between them. If you make an effort, there will be some response that is greater than you could have expected, which is a good way to describe grace. It's a response to an action that's more than what you would have thought the action would have created. And practice or effort and grace work together. So there is an evolution of consciousness, but that evolution won't go very fast without effort. And so the question is, why do people make a spiritual effort? And the answer is generally because they're dissatisfied. But at a certain point, your effort has to not be based on dissatisfaction. It has to be based on the simple joy of the result of your effort. So if you're a violin player or a piano player or an athlete, in the end, you just do it because you love to do it. And you don't do it because you're not good enough. You just do it because you love to do it. And because you love to do it, you get better and better at it. And the issue of not being good enough or being broken or needing to be fixed through spiritual practice, that's all a mistake. You don't need to be fixed at all, and you won't change very much if you don't practice. But is that practice because you're broken? Mm-hmm. Is that practice because you're not good enough? Well, a lot of people believe that, and if they do, then they co-create dissatisfaction and inadequacy along with their practice until one day they relax and go, oh, I just love doing this. That's why I do it.
But do you know many people who, in your classes and groups, I mean, yes, while you're speaking and you're transmitting a field, there is a presence, and I have felt that among people like you. And then have people had a permanent shift that you're aware of, and they've embraced the same I that is we consciousness that maybe you inhabit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Well, of course, if not, what would be the point?
No, but have people...
Do they have necessarily the same kind of experience that came so suddenly initially for me? Yeah. Yes, some do. Some do. And then I meet some that have had that experience and are struggling to integrate it, and then we just by being together, I help them integrate it, or they find one of my books, like the ones you mentioned, The Eye That Is We or The Black Butterfly, the more recent ones, The Mandala of Being, and then those books help them. My presence communicates through the books just as well in some ways as it communicates through me physically, or when I'm present, or through my voice. Yes, of course, this is very much transmissible. This is the great epidemic. This is the disease we all want to get. And it happily, just as, you know, hatred can be infectious, awakening to the wholeness of yourself in the moment is also infectious. And once people start on that path, there's no turning back. You will be changed. And I've been told by hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that their lives have been irreversibly changed, for which they are profoundly grateful. And the beautiful thing about it is that they go on to change other people's lives, so the epidemic spreads. And it's a joy.
Yeah,
I don't think creating a hierarchy of people that are enlightened or a hierarchy of realization, I don't think it's even worth talking about.
Right. No, it seems I agree with you. It seems like there are more and more people talking about this, getting the disease, if you want to say that, waking up to something, or at least the awareness that that is possible, even to wake up to something, is maybe the beginning. But I'm curious about the force or the emanation behind all that, behind what's happened to you and the present. Is there, I mean, it's sort of like the I that is we. Is there something? I mean, I'm just asking this because I'm not that I don't know the answer, but I sort of want to hear it. There is something behind us and all of us in this movement that is pushing for this, or there's something going on here, right?
Well, yeah, of course there's something going on. If you want
What
to
is
say that
that?
it's God or something like that, I would simply say that the relationship to God is a very private and personal and individual affair. But there is a power that is greater than the power of our individual personal egos. And it's very easy to recognize that power without even having to give it a name. I am aware of my thoughts. What part of me is aware of that? I am aware of what I feel, the sensations in my body, my moods. What part of me is aware of that? I am aware of the pacing of my words as I'm speaking now with you. What part of me is aware of that? And while I can just point to the part in each of us that is potentially can be aware of everything and anything that we're experiencing, the source of that is truly unknown. The root of that is unknown. Does it come from the brain, and does the brain just tune into it? What is the origin of consciousness? Is that the spark of God that certain spiritual traditions speak about that is in every person? Well, those are just the stories we make up. The fact is, there are some things that are a mystery, and science likes to pursue or chase down mysteries and get answers, and that's a good part of us. And it also, in doing that, sometimes forgets that mystery is mystery, and that it's healthy for it to remain mystery. So I don't know what the source is, but I don't need to know that to live in the power of it and to become a servant of the power of it, to keep
But is the
being, not
personality part, the part that's being observed, is that an illusion? Is that a false fabrication that isn't real?
well, in terms of personality, what immediately I think of is that every person gives expression to this kind of consciousness in a way that is natural to their personality, and therefore colored by their personality. And it's going to also be colored by their education and enculturation and relationship with their mother and father and spiritual upbringing or religious upbringing. But the actual consciousness itself, it's very, there's no way for us to say that we know or could know that that consciousness is different from person to person, whereas the expression is different. If I'm a potter, my pots may look very similar to someone else's pots, but they're not going to be identical, just like no two leaves or snowflakes are identical. So the expression of this consciousness is very unique. Some people are poets, and some people are artists, and some people dance it, and some people write it and speak it, and some people don't make much of a public presentation whatsoever, but if you sit down with them, there it is. There you are. And I think that the expression is just as unique as nature gives birth to new species and as unique as ecosystems are with the things that live in them. And I don't, it's not, just how did we get here, and how did nature get here as we understand it and experience it? And this consciousness that emerges is expressed just very similarly and yet very uniquely by each individual. The important thing is, and Barack Obama, President Obama, just used the word in the language of the indigenous original peoples of South Africa for that spark within each person that is part, that links everyone to everything, that he believed was so much a part of Nelson Mandela's life and Nelson Mandela's legacy. I don't think Nelson Mandela writes of any specific revelation or spiritual awakening, yet clearly he was very much the embodiment of profound spiritual insight and intelligence. So how that awakens in people is very different, very unique. He said he had a lot of time to be alone, 27 years, to reflect and think. You know, most of us are just too busy to really observe our lives or reflect or think about anything. We're so busy that we basically live out of conditioning. But if you're put in prison for 27 years, it's a really good opportunity to go out beyond your conditioning. And in his case, such a blessing for the rest of the world. So that, you know, that Obama chose to find that one word from the language, of that language.
What was that word?
Something like Mambutu or something. I don't know the word. I just heard Obama say it, and I heard the crowd applaud during the eulogy he made at Mandela's funeral.
I'm sure there's a word like soul or in every language or something that reminds us of this eternal consciousness. And of course, there's no, I'll ask this question, but I don't expect an answer that is based on any fact or anything. But what is the purpose of this consciousness embodiment? I mean, if there is just this singularity of essence, why does it incarnate into me and you and Obama and Mandela, all these individual identity?
I get your question, I think, really well.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's a singularity. It allows a, if something is prior to all objects, then every object can be seen. Or if I say that in a more simple way, the purpose of this consciousness that is in everyone is that we can be in relationship to ourselves, our thoughts, our sensations, our beliefs, our attitudes, our choices in such a way that we are in a constant process of co-creating or inventing ourselves, so that the evolution of, just like life continues to evolve and new species emerge. Sometime in the 1950s, through some interaction of a virus in monkey populations in Africa, the HIV virus came into being. It hadn't ever existed before. And that will keep happening. New viruses will come into being, and then they will inhabit animals, and some immune systems will succumb, and some immune systems will adapt. And then from that point on, the immune system will be permanently changed. And so goes history, and so goes the history of consciousness. So to wake what this is about, what its purpose is really dependent on how you ultimately invent yourself. And Mandela invented himself as a man who was a champion for reconciliation and forgiveness and for the rights of whites as well as blacks, the rights of minorities as well as majorities, and that balance that a leader through his consciousness and conscious self-inquiry arrived at that position is a blessing for all of us, because it shows us that every single one of us can outgrow our racism or our prejudice, or that what we mean by racism or prejudice is simply a particular position, but that the consciousness that's aware of that is limitless, and therefore your position can constantly change. You can outgrow yourself. That's why you would want to be on planet Earth. That's why you would have a marriage, and then if it fails, have learned because of the failure, and then remarried and experimented the meaning of intimacy in a new way, and maybe that marriage lives on, maybe that marriage fails, but fails in the sense of its continuity. But now you've learned more, and so the next effort to love, you love from a greater self-sacrifice, a greater self-surrender, a greater honoring of the other. And every single situation in life gives us an opportunity to outgrow ourselves, to invent ourselves. And without this one consciousness, or so we say, one consciousness, there would be no relationship, and everything would continue. And because that one consciousness isn't strong in most creatures, most animals, that once the bird learns to make a nest, it, you know, for thousands and thousands and thousands of generations, it makes the same nest. But human beings, we're able to outgrow ourselves very quickly. And we fight. We're afraid of those changes. We protect ourselves from it while others pioneer forward. And so we're inventing culture. We're inventing society. We're inventing cities and ways of life. We're inventing. You know, we're coming back to the recognition of that the basic nutrition of our hunter-gatherer ancestors is the basic nutrition probably best for us. We've intruded with our minds on everything, and generally, we needed to do that to find out why things were whole in the first place. The bird doesn't worry about whether things are whole. It just lives its life and everything is whole from its point of view. And they're territorial and they fight with each other and whatever, but they have their instincts. But they're not inventing themselves in new ways. They're not creating new tribes. They're not creating peace treaties. They're not socially and culturally evolving very fast. They may be evolving, but very, very slowly, because the consciousness you need to evolve is that deeper consciousness, which is a relationship with every thought, every feeling, every sensation, every perception, every instant, all the time.
Well, it does seem like humans have a unique perspective, at least from our angle. But still, with all these situations you name, the bird and, you know, all the habits of animals and even humans, ultimately it seems like footprints on the beach, on the sand that gets washed away, and was there a purpose for all of it anyway?
It's up to you what the purpose is. You're the inventor of your own purpose.
But you
can say there's no purpose and you can live in a kind of psychological or emotional emptiness, or you can say there's a purpose and your heart can be filled with the opportunity to embody that purpose to the greatest depth you can. It's really up to every person. I mean, that freedom, that free will, that's not going to go away.
But then it's all absorbed back into the oneness anyway. Look at all the people in history who have lived and are not here anymore, and they've had great experiences or little experiences. To be existential.
Alan, do you want to be seen? Is it truly important that you be somehow seen as somehow absolutely unique?
I don't know. Maybe that's my personality. I don't know if it's important. Maybe it is important.
Well, I think it probably is, and I think that if we struggle with a kind of fundamental dissatisfaction, it can make us cynical or it can make us surrender. And if we surrender, then we stop struggling as much. And if we stop struggling as much, maybe we are a little more the embodiment of love. Maybe that transmits to others and they struggle a little less and they become a little bit more the embodiment of love. But I don't think there's any position that's right or wrong. It's the one you're in right now. And again, as our president said at Obama's eulogy, you look at a historical person, and certainly on a spiritual path, there will be many people to look out historically, you know, from Rumi to Buddha to Jesus and on and on. And if we look at contemporary people that are so supposedly the embodiment of some kind of enlightenment, then we tell stories about those people, but the story is never the person. You really don't know what goes on in the private struggles of Richard Moss or Eckhart Tolle or Byron Katie. You don't know.
Right.
You don't know. And I know, because I've heard the words come out of me and I've written my books, that those words are at best an approximation of what I live moment by moment as a being. And therefore, I cannot represent myself to you in a way so that you would know me. And you'll never represent yourself to me or anyone else in a way that we will know you, except to the degree that we know the unknowable aspect of our own nature, and we know the vulnerability of not having answers to our own deepest questions, and that way we become brothers and sisters in a deep, deep mystery. And in that way, we see each other. And certainly we know what suffering is. I mean, the nurses took care of me, and the occupational therapist and the physical therapist last week when I had my total hip replacement of my right hip, and I was woke up after the procedure, and, you know, there's, and in the days since then, I mean, it just, every moment, every human being is making their contribution in their way. And it isn't about you or me as individuals, it's about the collective. It's about the evolution of humankind toward whatever we want it to be. For me, toward a world that welcomes every human being. How are we going to have a world that welcomes every human being and an economy to support that for every human being and a sustainable form of feeding ourselves and everything else? I mean, we have this incredible challenge of being earthlings and having to invent ourselves so that we can actually thrive on Earth and allow other creatures to thrive. And you know, what we've invented so far isn't good enough for us to ensure the continued existence of many species. We're in a very, very fast species die-off that we ourselves as human beings are causing. And we ourselves are in danger. And that means that we will learn and invent ourselves in new ways. And ultimately, we will have to conform to the constraints that nature puts on us. And that surrender to accept the constraints of nature as a human being is what we might mean is enlightenment. Or is a person that can't accept constraints is still too narcissistic to be part of the whole in a healthy way. And nature is constraining us. The environment is constraining us. Greenhouse gases will constrain us. Toxicity in water and air and food will constrain us. But it gives us the opportunity to transform. You know, you have to transform in a context. And we're transforming in the context of planet Earth. And we know very, very little about ourselves. We will, you know, so this is an amazing thing that we're journeying with. And as I'm talking to you, and I'm aware that you're in New York City, one of the most dynamic, busy cities in the world, and a very, 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 very small percentage of human beings are hearing what we're talking about. Most are tremendously active and tremendously busy and tremendously pressured and surviving and believing that survival is maybe economic success. We are slowly waking up to the fact that it's not about you and it's not about me, it's about we. It's about all of us, and it's not just about human beings or the human species. It's about everything on this planet, and then we'll realize that it's about everything beyond this planet as well. And
It seems like things are accelerating. Yes, we have a global crisis. We have an environmental crisis. We have a species die-off. And yet there's this greater and greater movement among people to awaken. And this moment of transition is leading somewhere. We're at a crossroads, but I have a hopeful vision of the future. I'm just curious what you thought. I mean, in a way, it doesn't matter because you're present, but I'm interested in what you see, a future of a planetary, a planet awake being and looking like, if you see that and what it looks like.
Well, the education of things like I've written about and Eckhart and many, many others have written about needs to be fundamental. We need an education for emotional intelligence. We need an education for spiritual intelligence. We need that as early as possible with our children. We need a reconciliation with nature for our children. We need to start to see ourselves as animals on a planet, as opposed to the sovereigns over the world that we find ourselves on. We're just one species among many, and that's what will emerge. We will surrender or give ourselves over to a greater sense of wholeness as we understand that, person by person, one person at a time, inexorably, because the awareness that we've been speaking about means that whatever level that we're at right now, as we become aware of it, we will outgrow it in certain ways and make changes and adapt and adjust and invent and create ourselves again and again and again. So I have an optimistic attitude also, that enormous change has to happen, and that at the heart of that change is a change in consciousness and in a change in lifestyle, profound change in human lifestyle at, from where it is now. Yes, that all will unfold. And some people see it as the intellect and technology giving us some sort of survival advantage, and it does. And at the same time, it has put us in the exact perplexing dilemma we're in now. We're too smart for our own lives, in a way. We're too clever. We use the intellect to make us separate and then to dominate what we perceive as separate from us. We don't use our consciousness to see ourselves as part of and one with all and as servants of a relationship with all that. And so that's the direction we have to go in to survive. And we are survivors. We really want to survive. You know, I'm very, very happy that I haven't got the slightest interest in financial survival. But that's not a meaningful value to me. There's a certain level that is necessary, and that certain level always seems to happen. And the less I want and the less I need, the freer I am. And I would urge that on everybody, and in every possible way. You know, simplify, 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 simplify.
But we do have an advantage, or people, you know, educated in the West. There's people who don't have the luxury, and I think you mentioned that before, of considering more than survival. And that's, I think, part of the crisis.
Do we have an advantage? I don't know that that's true. And, you know, even the few remaining indigenous peoples in the world are generally happier than you will find the average person in modern society. So we have an advantage, but the advantage is not that we are superior to other peoples who came before us. The advantage is that we can learn and change ourselves just like our ancestors did. We didn't domesticate animals because we knew what we were doing, and we didn't domesticate plants because we knew what we were doing. It just unfolded. And right now, we know a great deal about what we're doing wrong. But the point is, you never know, for example, what health is until you damage it. You don't know what a healthy environment is until you harm it. You don't know what a healthy diet and nutritional is until you make yourself sick with what you thought was healthy. And so we learn by trial and error. But the point is that which is aware in us is always more than anything we're aware of, and therefore we keep transcending, outgrowing ourselves. And in that process, we invent ourselves. And it's not, you know, my transformation, my awakening, yours, that's not an end in itself. It's only to the extent that it allows all of us to engage in a more successful, healthy way of living. And successful, I think, in this instance, means that we have more and more room for each other, more and more room for our differences, that the symphony of human differences is the more important music as opposed to my music. And if I can play with the symphony, then that's really wonderful. We in the West, we have valued the individual above the symphony, and that is our mistake. But to value the individual, the part, and the whole equally, that's an important idea to keep trying to live. And, you know, I was a doctor, and I just had surgery, and I was blessed by the skill of the surgeon, and I looked carefully for a good experienced surgeon. We're blessed by what we have created, and we are cursed by it, too. And we've created nuclear bombs, and we've created the industrialization of food production, and we've created genetic modifications faster than we've understood what we've really been creating. And so we're exceptionally clever, and soon one day or another we'll start to realize the most clever thing of all is to just enjoy living in the simplicity of what is, and not to imagine you're going to arrive there, because if it isn't really fulfilling you right now, everything you're doing to get fulfilled is being born of dissatisfaction. You got to land right here, right here. Start right now. Who we are begins now. Who we were begins now. Who we will be begins now. There ain't anything else but now. And that now puts me in connection with every person, all of nature, the whole planet, the solar system, the galaxy, and on and on and on. It's all now, and it's all one, and we'll find our way. And
now, I appreciate that, and I appreciate the space of consciousness you're speaking from. And so in that sense, do you forget that Richard Moss exists? I mean, do you disappear into that at moments?
Well, when I'm unhappy, Richard Moss exists.
Uh-huh.
When I'm happy, he doesn't. When others are happy with Richard Moss, he exists as part of that collective happiness. And Richard Moss is unhappy and doesn't... He can make a lot of other people unhappy.
What would make Richard Moss unhappy if Richard Moss knew that it was that illusionary self was not separate?
What would make me unhappy are just old habits of thinking.
I see.
What would make me unhappy is feeling a sensation in my body that's unpleasant or scary or distressing, and not trusting it. I mean, it doesn't mean I shouldn't, let's say, find out if it's illness that I can do something about. We're not talking about that. But there are sensations that all of us feel, and when we start thinking about it, then we make ourselves very unhappy. So what would make me unhappy is just the degree to which I haven't yet said a very complete yes to life as it is. And to say yes to that means to say yes to fear and loneliness and aloneness and emptiness and powerlessness and all kinds of feelings and sensations that are very, very normal and just a part of kind of the weather. Today it's a beautiful, sunny, quiet day and not as cold as it's been. But the weather can get warmer. It will get colder. It'll be stormy. It'll be peaceful. It'll be, you know, unexpected changes take place. And that's the way it is inside of our bodies. We're constantly experiencing changes in weather. And are we afraid of those changes? Do we distrust what we're experiencing? Do we have to take control? Is money going to make us safer? What is really going to make us safer?
Well, I guess that's the experiment in moment-to-moment existence is being with whatever the weather happens to be.
Well, I agree, and I know this. There were things I wanted to have happen at the hospital. Very specifically, I knew that I was, the anesthesia and the medications was causing a very, you know, a dire state of, let's say, constipation, and I knew what it was going to lead to, and I knew an impaction and all that, and I asked for help, but I asked in a way that I wasn't demanding. The people around me were working hard, and they were giving themselves with a great deal of heart, and so I gave myself with a great deal of heart. And by the time I left that hospital, the nurse that wheeled me down to the car wanted to. And we liked each other. And life had gotten better in her and in me because of our connection. And that was true with everyone I interacted with. And that's a choice. even in the midst of physical pain, even in the midst of feeling out of control, even in the midst of things that could be quite threatening. This, of course, was an elective procedure, and you know, I wasn't being forced into it by some dire illness. But how we live this moment, and particularly our relationships, with a big heart, with a real curiosity about each other, with a great sense of respect and empathy for each other, that's to me more important than whether someone's enlightened or awakened or not awakened. Every moment we make this world as wonderful and as beautiful as we can through the openness of our hearts, and that contagion is wonderful. If someone else gets a little bit bigger and fuller and happier in their being, then the next person they turn to, they'll be a little more generous, a little more empathetic, a little more compassionate, a little more understanding, a little more tolerant, and it just spreads and spreads and spreads. And, you know, that is how we will change our world. And it's the way we've been changing it all along.
Mm. Yeah, no, what you're saying about the people in the hospital there are some very, I think, just simple people that are very much in the moment, that are at service, and those are the truly the spiritually awake, because they're beyond any dogmas or even any book learning. They just are that way. And
well, no, I think we shouldn't idealize anybody.
Okay.
Because I'm just simply saying that if I had treated people with impatience, if I had been demanding, if I had been self-centered, they would have done their jobs, but they wouldn't have done their jobs with their hearts open. They wouldn't have done their jobs with a sense of gratitude for the opportunity to care for me or care mm-hmm. for another human being. I had a tremendous amount of responsibility for how I was going to be cared for through the way in which I was caring. And even though I was the patient, I was a patient who cared. I was a patient who was caring, respectful, appreciative, grateful. And I would have been, even if there had been negative complications, more severe than just being very constipated. You know, you just have to laugh. These people are not just special people that are, or simple people. They are just as complex as everybody else. And finding their way and going home to children and having mothers and fathers that are getting old, or you know, friends that are not well, or dogs that are sick, or cats that are, you know, tearing up the furniture. I mean, our lives are immensely complex, and we can simplify that by being very, very present and knowing that the most important thing right now is always an open heart and being really aware and not telling yourself a story that makes your life worse or makes you special. And then slowly but surely, you just become a spreader of something very sweet. It just emanates. And it would be pointless to call that an illumination or enlightenment. It's a choice. It's just this very wonderful, wonderful choice. You have to be able to face fear before you make that choice. You have to not let your fears cause you to become self-involved to make the choice that allows other people to shine with you. Every person shines, and the beauty of it is to let them shine. They have a specific thing they've learned, a specific gift. I mean, people who've wheeled me through the airports, they're not getting paid very much. They're not necessarily highly educated. They live in their own stories and dreams. And yet, if I listen to them and I welcome them, they shine in their own way. And by the time we part, something very precious has been communicated between us. And that, I mean, whoever's listening to this, that's your responsibility. That, more than anything else, in every moment, is a responsibility worth living for.
Mm. Well, as you're talking and talking about the people and them, and they're, you know, of course, everybody's complex and has their own worlds. And There are parts of the population that don't know about consciousness, though, and awakening, and they're just living their lives the best they can and responding to people in the best way they can. I think there's just something to be said about those people that are just living their lives the best way.
Well, you know, the notion of superiority and specialness is pervasive everywhere. Okay? So if you've had some sort of spiritual experience, or you've lived for a while in some monastic setting, or you've been in, you know, with certain great soul in their ashram somewhere, and you think that makes you special, well, then you're just as big an asshole as somebody who thinks they're special because they're paid more than most other people. I mean, specialness is just a form of ignorance. And most human beings will recognize a person who thinks they're special because of their consciousness achievements and won't respect that person because specialness isn't something we respect. That kind of self-involvement form of specialness. And so, the notion that there are people on a spiritual path and that are more special than people that aren't on a spiritual path, I don't think that that's a healthy notion.
No, I agree. There's lots of people on a spiritual path.
Everybody's on a spiritual path. Everybody is, whether they know it or
not.
Everybody's been blessed with consciousness.
Well, there's... Yeah, but as you were talking, just reminds me of this movie I just saw called Nebraska, and it's about just very simple people living their lives and the triumphs and the downfalls of those lives and in humility, in humbleness, if you want to call that special or not. But there's something to be seen in these people and in all of us just living our lives moment to moment the best way we can.
I mean, that's right.
I recommend this. I think you would like this film, Nebraska.
I've read about it, so I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, because it's sort of about what you're saying. This, I mean, of course, this idea of specialness is just an ego elevation, and I think consciousness breathes through all people, whether they're the person on the street or the president of the United States. It's the same thing, and ultimately we're having experiences we're having, and I don't know where...
Well, Nelson Mandela said it very beautifully. He said, no, it really isn't about me, it's about what we did. He said one of the most important things for him was to realize that there were some people who were doing things for their liberation movement who were much more skillful than him and much more capable than he was, and yet he became the symbol for it. He became the icon representing it. And he was very aware that it would never have been accomplished without those other people, and that he was not the most gifted of the people. And I know that absolutely for a fact. In that hospital context, I was one of the least gifted. You know, they had trained themselves to be skilled in ways I have not. You know, well, I did train in medicine long ago, but if we want to, there is the community of humanity and the community of life on Earth, and we are citizens of that. And I joked when they asked me in preparation for the medical, you know, am I a Caucasian? I said, no, I'm an Earthling. And but there are certain diseases that certain races have a greater or lesser predilection to. So from a medical point of view, there's a validity there in differentiating an African American from a Caucasian and so forth. But you know, I don't make that differentiation. We're all Earthlings,
right?
And someday we'll be all galactic beings if we get that far. And there's no doubt that all through it, we will have to do two things: both survive, which will take a certain kind of ruthlessness, and that the greatest survival skill will be our ability to embrace each other, which will take a great deal of humility and love.
Well,
and these things are not
the lesson we seem to be learning. There's nowhere else to go except that plan. You know, we are coming together as a plan. The internet has created a global village, and our survival depends on whether or not we cooperate as a planet.
I agree completely.
So what's coming up?
A lot of good things can happen through our interconnectivity.
Yeah, I think we're in an age of miracles because of the technologies we've created. And, you know, something happens in a small town somewhere, everyone knows about it and brings us together in collective empathy that wasn't possible before. And so I see a great future, possible future for us collectively, for the I that is we collectively.
Mm-hmm.
And what's up for you next? I mean, I know you're just living simply, but do you have any plans, retreats, something going on that you'd like to?
I have been doing retreats for 36 years or so. And I continue to do that. I go where I'm invited. I'll be doing a program in Golden, Colorado, outside of Denver, for 4 days. I just call it Deep Work for Essential Change. And I do that with my companion and partner, Annalisa. And then we're off to Europe, some of it family and a lot of it work in different places. So I just go with the flow of that. And I'm regularly mentoring people over the phone and over Skype. All they have to do is go to my website and see that opportunity is there.
What's your website? Can you give us your website?
Yeah, it's richardmoss.com, www.richardmoss.com. And there's a lot, most everything on my website is for free and give away, and there are a lot of short instructional videos for centering practices and heart-opening practices, and there's also my YouTube channel, and I post on Facebook almost every day. Missed the last 10 days or so as I got ready for the surgery and went through that process, but I posted again today. And I find it a lot of fun to be able to share what my life is telling me. So what's new for me is I'll just keep getting older until life ends. And hopefully along the way will help foster in other people a deep commitment to becoming as conscious and loving and responsible and as they can possibly be.
So just one more question. What do you think stands in the way of us becoming as loving as we can be?
Well, I would say two things. One, there's still many people who haven't become aware of their thoughts and therefore believe the judgments of themselves, positive or negative, believe their judgments of other people, believe their future, you know, stories, and believe their past stories. So it's the belief in our thoughts without the ability to challenge or question those thoughts through our awareness. That's one major problem. And the second problem is that we're afraid of many feelings. And those feelings, instead of us learning to be very creative and healthy in our embrace of the feelings, we let them chase us into thinking and into defensive, protective behaviors. So fear is the feeling that all of us have to make friends with. And there's only one fear with hundreds of different names, but it's only one sensation. And when you learn to have a healthy relationship with that sensation so it doesn't make you self-involved and special and close you down or make you aggressive or make you withdraw, then you really start to make a tremendous amount of progress. So the sensation we call fear needs to be understood as just that, a sensation. The stories about fear are not anywhere near as important as my conscious embodied relationship with that sensation right now. The stories are just stories and almost never true. And then our beliefs. You know, the things that you believe are just approximations of reality. And as long as they don't cause you to behave in a way that diminishes the freedom and dignity of other human beings, then you're free to believe anything you want. But as soon as those beliefs diminish even slightly the freedom and dignity of other human beings, it's time for you to discard those beliefs. And I would never believe in a God that tells me I have to work harder, because the moment I feel the sensation of being told I have to try harder or work harder or be more conscious or try to be more loving, and just that sensation in my body tells me that that's a story not worth dealing with. My God is completely accepting of every mistake I make and will always be.
There's a lot of people who are living in fear of their God judging them for the mistakes.
The truth of a belief is what it makes you feel and how you behave. And that's the only truth of a belief.
How do people overcome a belief that's been so ingrained that they feel they can't let it go, though? You know, there's been
that's a whole other conversation. I mean, they can go to people like me and read what I've written and see the free programs for being in the present moment on the website and teach themselves. I taught myself. Everybody else can teach themselves, too.
Well, thank you. You have any books coming up that you are working on?
No. No, maybe I'm pondering a little bit about if I could write the shortest and simplest book possible about the importance of relationship. I might do that. To me, what interests me most now is that the new spiritual teachings are going to emerge not from men or from women, but from couples. As we enter into profound intimacy with each other, it's going to emerge from people who are profoundly intimate. And for the individual who can't be profoundly intimate but has great wisdom, those teachings are also useful and valuable and have been around for a great deal of time. But we wanted to take, Mary Magdalene away from Jesus, and we've probably wanted to take the important females away from Buddha, and it goes around. I think the new spiritual teachings are going to emerge out of profound intimacy between people. I think there will even come a time we won't elect a president of the United States. We'll elect a first couple.
Because that sort of happens in a way in some situations.
We do. It does happen in a way.
We haven't touched on that, but do you think that you can only have that one intimate relationship with one person, or can it be everyone that intimacy of that loving relationship exists?
Well, actually, both are true. When you really, truly love that one person, he or she becomes all people. She becomes all women, or he becomes all men for you. And that from that point on, Every man or woman that you love is not someone that pulls you away from the person you are with, but is a reflection of the depth of intimacy you have with the person you are with. Is there a lot of experimentation that can go on in the process of learning what I've just said? Absolutely. Is there an absolute right way for any one person? Monogamy, for example? I don't know. Everybody's inventing what they want to invent, but I do know this. When you truly love deeply, that one person is all people. That one woman is all women. And therefore, no other woman really needs to be a love object in an exclusive way, nor other men. Man.
But that's a practice. Of course, it's what we're here to do is relate and love, but it takes work and dedication to have that happen.
It takes the process of self-invention to reach the point where you think or you believe, I would rather find out what intimacy is than be the hero, the solitary hero, man or woman. The hero's journey for me now is a journey of intimacy. And intimacy is not done by yourself.
Into me see, as Marshall Rosenberg says. Into me see. That does seem like a new direction. Intimacy, it's a whole other sense of being that hasn't been taught, hasn't really been spoken about in a way of unfolding the true self. And I think that would be an important area to open up to people, it seems.
Yes, and it's the place I love to work the most. Uh-huh. Working with people about the depth of their capacity for intimacy and relationship.
It takes two people totally dedicated to the one person. I mean, if you're one person dedicated to the intimacy, your partner has to match that, or it doesn't work. Do you find that true?
It does work. It's just that you learn the limitations of two people's different understandings of what consciousness is. And eventually, two people begin to realize that they can help invent each other, that I'm inventing my partner and she's inventing me. How I am with my partner transforms her. How she is with me transforms me. How we are with each other, our relationship itself is teaching. Our relationship is our teacher. It's our spiritual guide. It's our psychoanalyst. It's our divinity. It's our, that is the divinity instructing us about divinity. So the relationship and what it needs and wants becomes more important than what I need or want. And that is an evolutionary process to have arrived at this point and to say, well, just how deep can intimacy go? Just how much can the one become everyone? And
was that a discovery for you? Was that something that seemed like, oh, yes, this always was? Or was
well,
it no
at
way?
One level, I would say the very first book I wrote, The I, that is we, was that great first awakening and discovery. The realization, the we, that is I, is equally as true, has been an unfolding process. That the relationship is just as important as the individual. And in many cases, the relationship is actually more important than the individuals in the relationship. And until both people want what the relationship wants, the relationship can't teach them.
So the relationship is the teacher of consciousness. That's the connection between relationship and consciousness, huh?
That's exactly right. Consciousness is not something you awaken to by yourself. It always is a process of relationship.
I think that's a very good, unique, important teaching for people in the consciousness-seeking field, if you want to call it that. That's an evolution, for sure.
Yeah, well, the people that are unhappy in the consciousness field that I meet are the ones that are still looking for individual enlightenment.
Uh-huh.
Right. They still somehow think there's a personal enlightenment. Then there isn't.
That's very interesting. I know. I think that's quite unique and very important. And thank you for.
You're welcome.
We could do a whole show about that at some point. I'd love to just talk about it, maybe with you and your partner.
Mm-hmm.
About the context of relationship and consciousness.
Yeah. Well, we have people that come here and do retreats with us, couples, mm-hmm. and that just stay at our home with us and spend 3-4 days, and that's profound. And we work with couples. Most of those groups are completely full already, but we work with couples, and our next one is in Europe, and as I say, it is full. And she has her own work, I have my own work, and we work together. It's really quite an interesting journey. And as I would say now that, there isn't, as I said, the people who are unhappy in the consciousness journey are still looking for some form of personal salvation, mm-hmm. personal enlightenment.
And it doesn't. Your experience is it doesn't exist. That's an illusion.
Absolutely an illusion. There is no individual.
Mm-hmm. But there is the individual relationship that is, or maybe that's not even individual, the relationship.
Well, even me, if you say I'm an individual, then what part of me is aware of every single thing that I do that expresses my individuality? Mm-hmm. If I'm unhappy, is that awareness of my unhappiness unhappy? If I'm self-important, is my awareness of my self-importance a space of self-importance? There's a relationship. Consciousness is a relationship. There's no individual.
Right. I see that.
Now, there's a body, my body, it got operated on. It's taking medications. It's got a prosthesis in its hip. Yes, I have an individual body, but this individual body is actually not individual at all. If I'm with a group of people whose hearts are open and who are working together in a deeply collaborative, intimate way, I am much, much healthier than if I'm with a group of people who are angry and self-protective and competitive.
Yeah, I get that. And that's, yeah, I think if you take that and expand that to the planet, of course, then we have an enlightened society.
Yep.
And I think that is coming. Oh, that's my hope.
But it takes
the individual work to transcend the self that thinks it is separate. And
well, the illusion of separateness, which I wrote about in my first book, and which I thought that I had understanding of, I'm constantly seeing deeper and deeper into the illusion of separateness. It's not an easy illusion to escape from. And maybe there isn't any true escape from it. Maybe, you know, the only sense to separateness is the oneness that makes it possible for us to experience separateness. So, as I say, consciousness is a relationship. In me, in you, between us, it's always a relationship.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Alan.
I appreciate the time you've taken here just to talk about your life and your experience and to keep putting yourself out there as a voice that it seems compelled to share the experience and awaken others to who they are.
Yes, I put myself out there as a voice, but I'm just as happy of what happened between me and the nurses and the attendants at the hospital. I mean, there isn't a moment that we don't have an opportunity to be blessings to each other and for each other.
Well, I'm happy what happened here for me and you.
Thank you. Me too.
Thanks. And I'm talking to Richard Moss and his website, richardmoss.com. And yes, you'll be doing things in Europe. And maybe you'll come to New York sometime, you think?
As soon as some sponsor invites me, I will be there.
Okay.
You know, it's just a matter of someone inviting me and organizing it. And along I go.
Maybe I'll talk to the Open Center about that.
Why not?
Okay. Maybe a relationship, oneness and being in relationship at the Open Centers.
That would be fun. Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thank you, Alan. Keep bringing, you know, your unique way of asking questions and doubting and celebrating.
I'm doubting for everybody who's in doubt. And then
I understand.
Being there for everyone, because I'm not just a doubter. I mean, I've had experiences that have, when you talk, and of course, it reminds me of what I know, what
exactly.
I've experienced. So,
exactly.
Reminding. So, all right, we'll be in touch. I'll let you know when this is up and online, okay?
Perfect.
All right.
Thanks, and enjoy the holidays.
Yeah, and have a great recovery, too.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to go take a walk up and down my hallway.
All right. And, of course, say hello to your partner, who must be...
I shall do that.
Thanks, Richard.
Okay. Goodbye.
This is
for now.
Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. That was Richard Moss, the author of The Eye That Is We, The Black Butterfly, The Mandala of Being. And I'll post his website online with this interview. And if you want to reach me, you can go to my website, newrealities.com. You can email me at newrealities.com. Thanks for listening.